there's a long history. We know what happens when you have rent controls. You have no new construction and no maintenance of the existing housing stock, and you have a deteriorating housing stock, and yet city governments continue to implement that policy.
It's such a shame that what is good economics is often not good politics. Hi, and welcome to the Essential Scholars podcast. I'm your host, Rosemary Fike, and today we're going to continue our conversation about the UCLA School of Economics. I'm joined by one of the co-authors of the Essential UCLA School of Economics book. That would be Stephen Globerman. He's a resident scholar and the Addington Chair in Measurement at the Fraser Institute, as well as a professor emeritus at Western Washington University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
So I had the opportunity to speak with your co-author, David, about a lot of the parts of the book that he wrote. And I am so excited that I get to talk to you more about the parts of the book that you wrote. So one of the things we really didn't touch on in the first part of our conversation is the theory of the firm and how the UCLA school contributed to our understanding about why firms exist and what types of problems do they solve. So I would love to just to hear you talk about, you know, this issue.
Yes, thank you. What firms do is produce output and distribute output. And we can think of firms, almost any organization has a number of people working in the organization. And in fact, the bulk of output in North America is produced by large companies, which may have tens of thousands of people working for them. So how does all this activity get coordinated? There is a real issue of coordination. You have the need for teamwork, and therefore you have the need for encouraging and promoting teamwork. And that's one of the areas where the school contributed, particularly Alshin and Demsetz, where they made the point that almost all efficient production requires efficient teamwork. How do you get that? What do you need? Well, you need what they call the residual claimant, which is really an owner, someone who has the property right to the profits or the surplus of the organization. And when you have that residual claimant, you have one or more people, because in a large company, there can be multiple shareholders, thousands, in fact. But you have people who have a vested interest in ensuring, first of all, that the shirking that might go on is minimized. I mean, if there's a large group of people involved in an activity, any one individual might be tempted to say, well, if I don't pull my weight, as it were, no one's going to notice anyway, and I'm going to get paid, so why not shirk? Well, the residual claimant has the incentive to ensure that individuals do not shirk, that they are their team members and contribute their best to the team. The residual claimant also has the responsibility and the right to reward or to terminate employment. And that's the instrument that the residual claimant has, in effect, by hiring and firing senior managers who then manage the team basically for the benefit of the residual claimant. So that's one insight. The second insight is this notion that that residual claimants in a large organization can be effective in disciplining managers to run the business efficiently. And Demsetz had a very important article in this regard, where he said, look, there's been a lot of criticism about large companies. The criticism is that managers basically can do what they want because there are so many shareholders. The shareholders either don't have the incentive or don't have the capability to ensure that the managers are making that team work efficiently. And Dempsett's observation was that, look, as long as there's an incentive to make sure that the team is working efficiently, the residual claimant will put certain practices in place to help facilitate that job. So, for example, stock options, which are widely criticized, particularly by people like Elizabeth Warren, as being giveaways to managers. Well, stock options play the very valuable role of tying the performance of the organization to the compensation of the manager, which gives the manager an incentive to make that team an efficient team. If we do away with stock options or other types of compensation that are performance-based, well, that means that the shareholders have to do a lot more monitoring of managers. And they may not be, they may not be capable if it's a particularly complex type of organization, and B, they may not have the time or the inclination. So what's going to happen is people won't invest. They'll invest in other things besides companies because they can't make those, they can't be assured that the companies are going to operate efficiently. So the UCLA school has a lot to say about contemporary issues of how managers are rewarded, what managers should be expected to do, and in fact, how organizations should exist, because the organizational structure itself will be shaped to promote team production. Just give one example. Accounting firms and consulting firms are very often organized as partnerships or limited corporations. That is, they limit the number of shareholders. Why do they do that? Because monitoring the activity of those types of organizations requires some knowledge of what those organizations do. Not every shareholder would know, well, what is a legal firm supposed to do and when is a lawyer operating efficiently or not, but a partner in the firm observing the behavior of other people in the firm has a much better idea of who's shirking, who isn't, who should be rewarded more, who should be rewarded less. So the main point is that the governance of organizations respond to incentives, and shareholders have incentives to promote efficient teamwork.
So while you were answering, that made me think of, are there any circumstances in which shirking might be efficient? Because you have to invest in trying to eliminate and you know, identify when it's happening, and you know, those are costly activities. Are there situations where firms are like, let them shirk?
Well, the short answer is I agree with you, although I'd qualify that by saying that the concept of shirking kind of implicitly has the connotation that the you're leaving something on the table, that if that individual were not shirking, more output would be produced. But let's just, any type of behavior which on the surface looks inefficient might well be efficient once you take into account transactions costs and information costs. And an example would be inventories. I mean, why do companies and landlords in particular, for example, have inventory or vacancy, apartment vacancies? That looks inefficient. You should have full usage of every resource all the time. Well, that's not possible in a world where there's transactions costs and information costs. So, you know, in the case we talk about in the book of empty apartments, why would a landlord not just rent an apartment for any price they can get in the marketplace and not leave it vacant for more than 5 minutes? Well, because that would put an enormous burden on potential renters to be active in the market every minute of the day, because the price is constantly changing, and people, that would be a significant transactions cost. So empty apartments are basically an inventory to give people time to search. And it makes search less costly, and the reduction in search costs is greater than the loss in having some vacant resource lying around.
Yeah, when I was asking that question, I was very much thinking about myself and my summer job that I used to have as an undergrad. I worked at a landscape supply place, and all I did was really read books because it rains a lot in Pennsylvania, where I'm from. And so I shirked, but my employer didn't seem to care too much about it at all.
Well, it may also be that shirking, in the sense that I'm using the term, which is you are not being as efficient as you could be, even considering all of the costs of trying to be efficient. Shirking may be part of your compensation. And if you weren't shirking, you might get a higher salary. And so the employer might make a trade-off and say, okay, I'll let this person shirk for a while. But the compensation, the monetary compensation, is going to reflect that.
It was certainly not very much money. Are there any reasons to believe that firms are artificially larger than what might be efficient? So I know a lot of criticisms from people who are kind of free market types might say, you know, the government has granted, you know, corporations legal personhood. There's a lot of involvement in the state with legitimizing certain forms of business structure. What problems might that cause?
Well, certainly the UCLA authors of studies of regulation and of antitrust, and that includes Demsitz and Peltzman and Hilton, would say the real danger to competition is a regulatory monopoly, essentially. And what that would, of course, involve, it typically involves, is consumers paying more than they should, quote unquote, for the output, but then the regulator redistributing essentially the captured profits as cross subsidies. We talked about that earlier in the day. And what Demsitz would say is that, look, there's no guarantee that a private market, unregulated market, would not result in a single firm or a very small number of firms emerging as the sole producer or producers. Should we worry about that? Well, yes, we don't want companies to exploit consumers. But what Demsitz would say is, look, if any company in the private sector is making what economists call economic rent, which are profits above and beyond what's needed to keep the company in business, then you have an incentive for other firms to enter and compete away those rents. And what Demsitz believes he found, and Peltzman supported him with some empirical work, is that large firms tend to be more efficient in settings where you have particularly large firms. And it's not primarily a function, their profits, that is not primarily a function of their market power, that is their dominance in the marketplace. It's a function of their efficiency. And if they stop being efficient, new firms will enter and take market share away from them. So the protection against monopoly abuse is an open market and the potential for entry.
Yeah, you have a nice section in the book titled "Does High Market Share of a Few Companies Imply Market Power?" And so in your response just now, you touched on some of the things that get brought up in that chapter. And so, you know, lack of competition or having very, very large firms, that's supposed to be, you know, from you know, mainstream economic theory, that's supposed to be a no-brainer, where we need to get the government involved in kind of reducing that market share. But as you said, it's not always just about the market share, it's about the efficiency. Is there kind of a pattern to the type of markets where large firms tend to be more efficient?
Yes, I think there's certainly a pattern where you have large fixed costs and relatively low marginal costs firms that operate efficiently are going to be pretty far out along their cost curve and therefore pretty far down the demand curve. That is, they're, if they're efficient and they're setting prices competitively, they're going to wind up with a large market share because they can supply a large part of the market at a relatively low price and be acceptably profitable. So, you know, industries like the petroleum refining industry and now network businesses like Meta, formerly Facebook, and Alphabet, formerly Google, are examples of companies where there are obviously large, what economists call economies of scale, meaning being large can provide you with opportunities to be low cost, but you have to take advantage of them. You have to implement what we were all earlier talking about, efficient team production, in order to leverage those economies of scale.
In that same section of the book, you mention a few other practices that seem anti-competitive on the surface, but UCLA scholars highlighted that they're really not so anti-competitive after all. So you mentioned things like territorial restrictions or, you know, advertising, those types of management of resale prices. Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that we think about as being not competitive and why we might be mistaken about some of those things?
Yes, and I would say, As a preliminary, that the antitrust law in the U.S. and the Competition Act in Canada identify certain practices as not per se illegal, but as creating a presumption that large businesses might be acting in ways that are not in the interest of consumers. And territorial restrictions are one example. So what's a territorial restriction? Well, for example, Caterpillar in Canada, Caterpillar, they make heavy earth moving equipment that are used for mining operations, for large construction sites, etc. In Canada, Caterpillar had a practice of essentially designating a single company as having the franchise to sell and service Caterpillar equipment in that province. Well, on the surface, that looks anti-competitive. You have only one supplier and servicer of Caterpillar equipment in Alberta. Why don't we have more? And the consumer presumably will be better off by being able to shop at different sellers. Well, what the UCLA school suggests is that you need to recognize the reality of markets, including things like transactions costs and information costs. An earth moving machine costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. And anyone who buys that machine wants to use it efficiently. They don't want it lying around because they can't get a part to repair the machine. They also want to know that if they're going to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for a machine, it's going to do what the supplier says it's going to do. Well, let's imagine a situation where you had multiple sellers of earth-moving equipment in Alberta. Well, one of those sellers might have an incentive to say, okay, I'll sell this machine to this customer, but I have no intention of servicing it. In fact, I have really no great interest in ensuring that the machine does exactly what the customer wants it to do, because if it doesn't work out, well, Caterpillar's the one that's going to get it's the brand name of Caterpillar that's going to be hurt. I'll be hurt, for sure I'll be hurt, but my hurt is a small share of the total hurt that occurs. If you have one seller, that seller is going to lose an enormous valuable franchise if they do not perform the way Caterpillar, the manufacturer, wants them to perform. So Caterpillar is effectively saying, look, we're giving you a very profitable franchise that we'll take away if you don't maintain the brand name the way we expect you to. And in structuring the arrangement that way, they create an incentive for the seller to maintain the brand name. And that's also what the UCLA school said about advertising. For years, economists would argue about, well, is advertising wasteful or not? And the debate came down to, well, what exactly is the ad that I'm looking at? Does it tell me objective facts about the product, or does it give me some aspirational feel-good messages? You'll be popular with when you use our product. What the UCLA school said is that that's all beside the point. The real purpose of advertising is to create a brand name and to demonstrate to the marketplace that you've got a strong commitment to keep that brand name. Because if you've spent tens of millions of dollars advertising a product and you don't produce a product that makes consumers happy, you're out of business and you've lost tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. So advertising is really a sunk cost investment to signal to the marketplace that your product is going to be a satisfactory product at the price. Now, if information were costless and there were no issues of interpreting information, that wouldn't be done. I mean, why would you do it? You just have to show your product to the consumer, give them a test run, and that's the end of it. They'll like it or they won't. By the way, that's an interesting case, which is not discussed in the book, but which certainly is a corollary, is when the government, or let's put it this way, when the government allows for restricted advertising, that could hurt the consumer. I'm thinking of things like the dental associations and the medical associations who say to their members, no, you can't say that you're better than the other dentist down the street or the other physician. Now, that'll confuse consumers and it'll degrade it'll degrade the profession. Well, what it really does is it prevents people from committing to good quality. So
interesting. I thought you were going to talk about in the US when they restricted the ability for cigarette companies to advertise at all. That was something that the cigarette companies wanted because then it acted as kind of a barrier. No other company could then get their brand out there to other people.
That's right.
So in a sense, maybe limiting people's ability to advertise is the true anti-competitive practice.
Yes, in many cases, indeed.
So I want to talk a little bit about regulation and the unintended consequences of regulation. I know this is something that we touch on later in our policy conversation, but I want to understand a little bit about, Peltzman and some of the really interesting examples that he goes into, like with the FDA and some seatbelt examples. I think these are really, really fascinating. And so I would love to hear you talk a little bit about Sam Peltzman's work and those particular examples.
Yeah, so Sam Peltzman was, one of his very famous articles was an evaluation of 1962 legislation in the US, which required drug companies to prove not just safety, but efficacy in the use of the drug that they were trying to sell, bring to market. And what Sam discussed was that, look, this is another cost and another barrier to bringing new drugs to the marketplace. And maybe the FDA thinks it's doing everyone a service by discouraging inefficient drugs from being produced and marketed. That's a waste of resources, obviously, if it really is inefficient. But what Sam said is, look, by creating this additional barrier to bringing drugs to market, you may prevent efficacious drugs from coming to market. And he showed that, in fact, in that trade-off, the FDA discouraged a large number of new drugs from coming to market that only a small percentage, in retrospect, might have been considered ineffective. And that therefore, patients on balance were made significantly worse off by that particular regulation. He also then, in another famous article, talked about all of the regulations related to safety features in automobiles, seat belts and the like. And what he said was, look, in theory, the rationale for these regulations is it's going to save lives, because if people get into accidents, well, they'll be better protected against serious injury or in extreme death. And what Sam said is that there's an unintended consequence. The unintended consequence is people drive faster and they drive with less care. And as a result, there's incidental damage done to pedestrians and motorcyclists. And on balance, it's not clear that the total, let's call it, quality of life years saved with these safety features is positive. It may well be negative. And then there was a very controversial discussion that Sam had.
It's very counterintuitive, and it's very reminiscent of Adam Smith's Man of Systems issue, where we have this social problem that we want to solve, and we think we can manipulate the incentives just in the right way to get the result that we want, but people respond to rule changes in ways that are sometimes unpredictable. There's many examples that we could think of. I know the childproof pill bottles was another example in the U.S. that we wanted to have, childproof pill lids to prevent children from having accidental ingestion of drugs. But the population of people who uses the most medications are elderly people who do not have an easy time opening those bottles, right? Exactly. And so you get the lids left off completely.
That's a great example. Yeah. I was going to add that in some cases, the unintended consequence is totally predictable, and yet the regulator goes ahead with the regulation. I mean, rent control is a great example where there's a long history. We know what happens when you have rent controls. You have no new construction and no maintenance of the existing housing stock, and you have a deteriorating housing stock, and yet city governments and continue to implement that policy.
It's such a shame that what is good economics is often not good politics. It's such a shame. So I want to think a little bit about some of the more intentional outcomes of the regulatory process. So you had just mentioned that some of the unintended consequences are predictable, but regulators go ahead and pass the rule anyway. But in the book, you talk a bit about something called what we call regulatory capture, and how there are intentional outcomes of the regulatory process that might be inconsistent with what is best for society. So what are the goals of the regulator?
Well, as we were talking about earlier, the one feature of regulation, it's a ubiquitous feature of regulation, is cross subsidies. Mm-hmm. Some people's income is transferred to other people. And to do that, you need to protect the marketplace that's providing the subsidy, because otherwise the subsidy will be competed away. The source of the subsidy will be competed away. So in Canada, we still have a significant cross subsidy that goes from urban centers, that is subscribers in dense urban centers such as Toronto, to rural subscribers. That's an intentional cross subsidy. it's not an unintended outcome. But to do that, the regulator needs to ensure that the phone companies earn enough money so that they can cross-subsidize from their lucrative markets to their less lucrative markets. And so we have in Canada restrictions on foreign competition. The government, the Canadian government, has a process in place where if a foreign telephone company wants to enter the Canadian market, they're restricted in terms of how much of the market they can take, 10%. Well, that's part of the way that the regulator, in this case, the government acting through the regulator, the CRTC, is going to ensure that those cross subsidies can continue. Because if entry were not restricted, where would companies like Verizon or AT&T go in Canada? They'd go to Toronto. They'd offer wireless service in Toronto and Vancouver and Calgary in the dense urban centers, and then the price would come down, and there goes your source of cross subsidy to the rural subscriber.
You have a few other kind of interesting examples in the book that I would love for our listeners to hear a little bit about. You talk about public transportation and streetcars. Can you just kind of run through that kind of example for us?
Yeah, well, that was an example that was in George Hilton's article, famous article about jitneys. And basically in the early 1900s, municipalities, he was talking about the U.S. in this case, municipalities gave franchises, monopoly franchises to surface rail companies to run from point to point, to carry passengers from point to point within cities. And of course, that was not as efficient as one would like, because if you didn't live near the main line, literally the main line, rail line, well, then you would have to do a lot of walking or bicycling or somehow get yourself from the station that you were entering or leaving from to your house or your business. And so that created an incentive for private automobile operators to act as essentially as common carriers, that is to go out and pick people up who wanted a ride from point A to point B that wasn't on the main line. And in fact, it was an extremely successful form of competition, so successful that the mainline surface rail companies complained to the municipal authorities that this was going to drive them out of business, because their pricing structure, not only their route structure, but their pricing structure was not satisfying market demand. They charged a single, started out at 10 cents, that's a long time ago, 10 cents no matter how far you rode on the train. Well, people who were only going a short distance weren't too happy about subsidizing people who were going the long distance. And so the jitneys offered differential pricing based on distance and even time of day. If you use their service during the peak hours, you'd pay more. And if you use their service during the off-peak, less, whereas the surface rail company just prices 10 cents regardless of when you get on. And so the jitneys were driven out of business by the regulators, and the monopoly franchise was maintained. But of course, technological change made that surface rail less efficient than, say, buses, because at least buses can turn corners and they don't have to go along a single route. They can go along a number of routes. But here we have Uber and Lyft, ride-hailing companies, which are basically the contemporary jitneys, saying that, look, we can do this more efficiently for a lot of consumers. And of course, you have now what amount to the taxi cab drivers, not surface rail companies, saying to regulators, this is unfair competition. These people aren't doing X, Y, and Z that we do, and therefore you shouldn't allow them in business. So Hilton's conclusion is, look, allow entry, but don't favor certain participants in the market and disfavor others. I mean, if the jitneys are going to use the roads and they're going to cause road damage, they should be charged for the road damage that they cause. But preventing entry really almost always amounts to only delaying entry and often encouraging entry, which is less efficient than some other form of entry that you might have had. For example, jitneys were more efficient than buses, but the regulator allowed buses to replace the streetcars because, again, that was creating cross subsidies that the regulator wanted to have in place.
One of the thoughts that you leave us with in that particular section on regulation is that just because we can identify that there's a market failure or a social problem, it does not imply that government regulation is necessary or that it would even result in an improved outcome. And so I think that goes back to the Nirvana approach that the UCLA school employs. I thought that that was a really fascinating end thought. But it seems like when people spot social problems or market failures, they push for regulations. What might you encourage people to look at instead? Or how would you encourage people to kind of temper that urge or to not buy into that Nirvana fallacy so much?
Well, I guess in the most possibly the most effective remediation would be to follow the money. I think people when they read about a proposed regulation might ask themselves the question: who really is going to benefit from this? Is it really going to do what the regulator claims it's going to do, which is typically some kind of social purpose? For example, a lot of cultural regulation in Canada is built around the idea that national identity depends on having quote unquote Canadian culture. Well, what is actually being produced? Does it seem to contribute to a stronger national identity, or does it seem to create subsidies for certain participants in the economy, such as local newspapers or writers and directors of Canadian films and books? So I think trying to understand who really benefits from this is one step that might help.
So what are some criticisms of the UCLA approach? I know one of the criticisms you mentioned in the book is that the UCLA school is a staunch defender of free markets and they're a bit ideological, but that's not exactly a fair assessment. Are there other common criticisms that get levied at this approach?
Yeah, I think another criticism, which is really a methodological criticism, is that the analysis is too simplistic. It's not heavy-duty mathematics and econometrics. That is, mathematical and statistical tools were not, they really weren't the main instrument that the UCLA economists used. They would use statistics, of course, but it was mainly logical thinking from some reasonable assumptions and using empirical evidence that modern day economists and even economists at the time, some economists were saying, well, this really isn't state of the art analytical work, and therefore why should I trust it? It's just too simplistic. And I can assure the listeners that people like Alshin and Sam Peltzman were very mathematical. I can remember the first class I had with Armin Alshin. It was a graduate course in microeconomics, and he didn't even introduce himself. He just started writing Lagrange equations and using calculus to differentiate. And we were all looking at each other. We thought this was an economics course, not a math course. But they didn't think that that was the way to analyze real world problems most effectively, that they didn't need all of that apparatus.
I think that's fascinating. There definitely is an attitude in the economics profession that math and formal modeling is equivalent to a rigorous analysis. And I do agree that the scholars that are part of the UCLA school definitely show that that's not the case. They're not always, one and the same. You can be very rigorous without having a paper that is full of equations. Well, Steve, before we go, I would love to hear if you have any kind of last thoughts that you'd like to leave us with regards to the UCLA school.
Yeah, I think what I would like to leave the listener with is the insights that the UCLA economists had are very durable. I mean, there's almost nothing I can think of in retrospect that I would say, well, this is clearly not right about what they said. And policy, while it's always changing, still reflects a lot of the insights of the UCLA school. So I think that's a real legacy of the economists there.
That it is an enduring legacy that we can continue to use this framework to understand modern problems. And in part three of our conversation, David will be joining us and the three of us will talk about some of these modern problems that we can use the UCLA school to understand. Thank you so much for your time today, Steve. I've had a lovely time talking with you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Essential Scholars, a new podcast series that explores the ideas and insights of some of history's most influential thinkers. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to subscribe and head over to essentialscholars.org to learn more. See you next time.